And so we're lucky to have Gabriel talking about I didn't actually know what the topic was going to be, but it looks like you're going to be doing LLM agent
Yeah,
discussions today.
it's a
So
lot of different things actually.
oh,
So,
okay, that's great. So
yeah.
Gabriel's, he recently finished his PhD where he focused on interpretability, and he's had a lot of focus not just on interpretability methods, but also interpretability tools, and the interpretability community at large has been have been things that have been part of his practice, not just the academic output itself. And so we're really lucky to have Gabriel working with us on NDIF. Have us build the interpretability community and infrastructure this way. And so okay, so we'll welcome Gabriel.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, David. Thanks, everyone, for having me. So the presentation for today, it's actually a bit of a lot of things packed into a single presentation, but I want to just give you a quick overview first. Like, as David said, I recently graduated from the PhD. I was in the Netherlands working on this consortium that focused on explainability for text, speech, and actually even music mo models. And my thesis was focused on interpretability for machine translation. And as you see from the title, there's this actionable keyword there. So my core focus wasn't really to try to, I don't know, develop new theoretical understanding of models, but rather how can we bring the advances that we currently have in the field of interpretability to users of machine translation models in a way that like they can use this information to make more informed choices. So a lot of my work was, for example, working with human post editors that could access uncertain information from model internals and decide whether it makes sense to correct, for example, some translation. So, and right now I'm here in David's lab and I'm working with the NDIF project. And the idea here, my personal focus is more related to building tools and interface to support workflows towards frontier LLMs. So kind of like trying to scale a bit interpretability, which is also a bit the focus that I try to give to this presentation. So I would want to start with some conceptual framing here. So I think everyone here knows about evals, LLM evals, and LLM interpretability, right? So I would argue that these are kind of like two different words that don't talk much these days, right? And it's kind of a pity because both are concerned with model understanding, right? So on the one hand, you have evaluations that are mostly behavioral, right? You're running your models, you're getting black box output behavior, and this allows you to be very to scale very well on a lot of data. So you can test over plenty of data sets, but it's quite shallow, right? Because the moment that you flag the behavior, you don't quite understand what is motivating this behavior, right? Is it that the model is misbehaving on this specific example or in a category of example? Which components are responsible for that, right? You cannot know just black box. On the other hand, interpretability is great because you can really probe deeper, right, into the model, understand which components are responsible for different stuff. But the problem is that, as many of you know, like if you ever try to run a patching experiment, good luck doing this on like the setup that black box people run their evaluations on, right? So in general, I feel like this is an interesting word because evaluation definitely can motivate interpretability analysis, right? Like you can pinpoint patterns here, and this can motivate where to focus for interpretability. And in the other, on the other hand, you can use interpretability findings to justify why some evaluation results were like the ones observed, right? So I think the main problem here is that there is a tooling gap between these two words, right? There is like this issue of like once that I have my evals, how do I move to the interpretability side? So I think that's the core focus that I want to try to address. And that connects a bit with my previous research, right? So just to give you a quick overview of today's presentation, the first part of the presentation is about scaling context understanding. So a lot of my previous work was about attribution. And a lot of my concern was actually about how do we make attribution more scalable for language model settings, right? So for these kind of autoregressive prediction settings. So in this context, I had this PECORE framework, plausibility evaluation for context reliance, and its extension applied to retrieval augmented generation for citations. So the core here was faithful citations that could outperform self-citation from the model just by looking at its internals, how it uses information. Then the second part is indeed about agents, and it's about how can we study agents not only from a behavioral perspective, but from a representational perspective. And here I will discuss briefly our recent work about studying goal directedness in a toy setup for LLM agents. So this is a bit rough. There are still rough edges here, so your feedback will be super useful. And the very final slides are actually, this is a bit annoying, but about bridging the tooling gap, and it's about what we are thinking about here in the EnDIF context. So trying to how do we scale the EnDIF ecosystem to kind of bridge this tooling gap that I discussed earlier. Any question on that? Any part that you find more interesting so that just to understand how to allocate time, maybe we're gonna be out of time.
Who's interested in number one, and who's interested in number two, and who's interested in number three? Number one, people?
Number one,
Number two?
scaling attribution.
Number two? People interested in
All
number
right,
two?
so we're gonna talk
Number
about
three?
agents. All right,
Okay.
cool. Number three is very short, so
Okay.
okay, I'll be quicker on the first part then. So just to give you a very brief overview of gradient-based attribution, I think a lot of you already saw that this slide. So you start with some inputs. This is passed through the language model. You get a distribution over probabilities. And then to do gradient-based attribution, what you normally do is you select a target, in this case, for example, the probability of the output, and you propagate with respect to this target to get gradient vectors, right? So these have the same shape as the original embeddings. And one way to get a score per token is to simply aggregate these at the token level. So, for example, the L2 norm of the gradient vector becomes a single score that tells you how important this token was re with respect to the prediction, right? So, this was the famous saliency map that a lot of people in interpretability are now saying that it's a dead direction, right? It doesn't exist anymore. And since the rise of mechanistic interpretability, saliency map are out of fashion, right?
And yet, that's what everyone cares about in industry,
Exactly.
and all they do.
Well, but apart from that, I would argue even in MechInterp, we still use saliency a lot, right? All the circuit finding work is using some notion of saliency to detect edges, right? Like edge attribution patching is saliency effectively. To find CLT circuits, you still use saliency. So back when I was starting my PhD in the pre-ChatGPT era, we were I decided to start building some tools for doing easy attribution on language models. So this InSeek tool was simply a wrapper of Hugging Face that would allow you to do very easily attribution on generation, right? So the problem that I stumbled on very quickly is that if you start working on realistic settings like reasoning models or retrieval augmented generation, you get these kind of monstrosities here, right? So what you see here is a saliency heat map of generated token by input tokens that you can see here. There is a diagonal, meaning there's new tokens that get added to the generation, right? So it's autoregressive. And then every one of these little scores is basically the saliency of an input token towards the prediction of an output token, right? So the problem is that if you want to do this kind of thing, you have to do attribution at every step, right? You have to do for the next token, I attribute all previous tokens, right? So that I get this kind of pairs. But then you can imagine that this is one backward pass per step, right? At the token level. So super expensive, right? So this scales very poorly with the kind of setup that we have. So what do we actually care about, right? I think it's interesting, this image, because it shows you that there is some information here, right? It's not a very uniform map. But how do we know that we care about these things, right, in the first place? Can we just scope our analysis to these things to make it more efficient and scalable, right? So now I want to give you an example of how we do the evaluation in the context of attribution. So you might have seen some data sets in this context that have this kind of assumptions about some hypotheses, right? So if you're interested about gender bias, you might have this kind of examples where you have a text that is, after she finished working, the pretty manager went home because she was tired, right? Then you might have some human labels here that say, well, this token here, the token of interest, was predicted because of the presence of the same pronoun before, right? So she motivates she. This is human judgment, right? And then you could use this data set to test a language model with attribution and see which tokens are salient, right? So maybe the language model will say, actually, it's the pretty token in this example that motivates the prediction of she, right? So I think this is a cool example because it also shows this pattern of right for the wrong reasons, right? So the model would predict she correctly, and you would never know that it's doing it for the wrong reason unless you were to look at the token that it's using, right? So again, this is an example of how we do this plausibility evaluation with human labels. But the concern here is that this is hypothesis-based, right? So I had to build a data set of examples like this one, where I have this token labeled as my target that I want to explain, right? Useful to narrow down specific phenomena, but how do I scale this in a data-driven way, right? So the problem is that you cannot find these plausible or implausible relations in the wild, just running your model, right? So this was our initial motivation to try to scale this in this scenario with this framework that we call plausibility evaluation of context reliance. Now I will give you a brief example of how it works. So let's say that we have a text like this. So I moved the table, it was very heavy. And we say that this first example is the context, right? I moved the table. So if I were to translate this to a language that has gender, for example, French or Italian, this pronoun is ambiguous, right? The model wouldn't know how to translate it unless it had access to the source. So in this case, we would have a translation like this. In French, j'ai déplacé la table, elle était très lourde. Okay. So how do we know what is context dependent here, right? So one way with our method, and then I will show a bit better how it works in practice, is that what we care for is detecting which tokens in the target generation are context sensitive, right? One way to do this is to measure, for example, the gap in probability or the KL divergence between the full distribution between the version with context and without context, right? So this tells you this token is context sensitive. And then from there, we want to do attribution back to contextual cues, right? So then the cool part is that this retrieves this kind of pairs that are influential influenced, right? Context and target. So now let's see an example in factual QA for that. So let's see, we have this query that is, how old is the Pannekoekkerk in Groningen? So this place doesn't exist. It means pancake church. Okay, it's a fictional place. So if you prompt Zephyr 7b with that, the model would say some answer and then would say, actually, you're asking me a wrong question. This question is like, it doesn't make sense, right? This place doesn't exist. So what if we are to add this context? So here I'm just adding a small system prompt in which I ask the model, provide me with a concise answer containing only a few words. And then I also give it a bit of a fictional context that I made up, right? In the heart of Groningen, nestled between quaint cobbled street, etc. So now the response of the model is going to match what it sees in the context, right? As expected. So that the church is 143 years old, built in 1877. So what Pecoret, so if we apply Pecoret to this example, what we get is that 143 is context sensitive, but not all the rest node, which makes sense, right? So the question is already enough to lead to an answer that is in this form, up to the date, right? But then the date is dependent both on the original date written in the context, but also on the fact that we mentioned few words. So I think this is a cool example of like how this can lead to data-driven discovery of dependencies, right? Because you could have imagined this, right? You could have guessed that there's a link between the dates. But I would have not guessed that this would be relied to few words here, right? So the fact that the model is looking a few words there, it means that probably without the context, it could have come up with something like "he's an historical building," blah blah blah, right? It could have gone on, but actually now it's just giving the answer, right? And another interesting thing is then also 1877 in the answer is context sensitive, mapping again to 1877 in the context, right? So this might look quite natural, right? It's just the token looking at the same token in the context. But actually, there's an interesting assumption here, which is this token is not being computed by looking at this date and working backwards, but it's just copied by the context, right? So it might be that these two things are mismatching just because the model is referring to the context twice, right? So, of course, this is just attributional, right? So there is no causality here, but it's great to come up with hypotheses for causality testing, right? You can now test whether patching. Yeah.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
Try this method on sort of more, I guess, like situations where you have more idea of the ground truth, like if you have like a hidden background, or also this there is some work that was trying to elicit like suppressed knowledge in Chinese only models. That was like a strange out of them. So do you think there's like opportunity for this to the most kinds of scenarios?
Yeah, I think so. I think there is. We haven't tried. The only thing that we tried was in a case for the example that I'm showing just here about retrieval augmented generation citations. So normal methods that create these kind of citations use superficial similarity, right? Like I take the similarity of the paragraph with the similarity of the answer, and if it's high, I just say this is a citation, right? But if your model has a backdoor, and maybe it's just mentioning a word all the time, if there is a trigger, right? Similarity would never pick this out, right? But attribution would. So I think that's a good motivation, right? You can actually get a more faithful sense of what matters towards the generation. So to give you a more better intuition, this was a follow-up in which we applied the same framework in the retrieval augmented generation setting. So the setup is the same. We have a version without context, a version with context, and the context here is three documents that are retrieved dynamically at inference time and are used to let the model come up with a better answer, right? So the way that Pecore works in this case is first we find the influence generated token, like we saw before, and this is done by looking at the distribution for every token that is generated with the context and without the context, and see in which position this gap is larger, right? So then in this case, for example, we would flag smaller as context sensitive, right? Once that we have that, we can do attribution to trace it back to influence token, to influential token, sorry. So I think the interesting part about the second side that I didn't show, is that the way that we do this is actually by using the gradient of the difference in probabilities between the two options. So, like, the cool part of this is that let's say that smaller was predicted with context, right? But PC would be the top prediction without context, right? Basically, we are mining a pair of like valid answer with without context, which we can use for doing this contrastive attribution there with gradients, that is not just measuring what is important towards smaller, but what is important to shift the distribution towards smaller from PC, which is the original choice, right? So this makes it a bit more robust in its application, right? I don't know if it's clear. Yeah.
For the second one,
Yep.
is this like a pipeline? Like first you find the documents that are important, and then from there you gradient each individual one, or do you just do like gradient attribution over all the documents?
So the cool part is that once that you have all these tokens that are context sensitive, one by one, you can just do one backward, get all the saliency over all the tokens of all the documents, right? So it's quite efficient actually, because this number of tokens is usually smaller, right? Yeah,
It is
that's it.
with all documents in context.
Yeah,
Okay.
that's right. So this, maybe there were some recent work that we're trying to approximate to do some similar stuff with ablations, right? There was some work from MIT, I think, where people were trying to do this kind of LIME estimator for importance of different sentences. Yeah, Koyana? So we just propagate the gradient from the prediction to the input embeddings. So it's all the way, kind of.
This is preluding the last part of your talk, I think. But if you have a very long context, like you often have in a RAG scenario, just doing backprop can be very hard
That's
to
right.
do that. So do you have some thoughts on how to?
Yeah, so this method is quite brittle in terms of which attribution method you're using, actually, right? So the better, like the cool part is that it's flexible as a framework in the sense that it's plug and play with whatever attribution you want to have, right? So in the original study, we were using raw gradients, and that was pretty bad, actually, in the sense that it's a very toy scenario that works in small contexts. But the moment that the context become large, then it becomes very diffuse, right? And you lose a lot of information, right? So there's new methods, gradient-based still, that would support this kind of pipeline. For example, this attention LRP or like GIM that we're using for a later slide, that are much better at kind of like narrowing down which tokens are important in a more robust way. Yeah.
So that's talking about how good they are. I'm just saying that even efficiently calculating gradients for a very long context
Right.
is very hard. Like
Yeah.
we ran into this problem in a project with Pfizer. They have a system, a RAG QA system on like thousands of documents or something. So just doing backprop, we couldn't do that on our machine.
Yeah.
Maybe do it.
So one solution for that could be to try this kind of forward-only attributions, like this kind of information flow routes, but they are definitely not output based, right? They just rely on local similarities, so it's not very precise. But nice. And I just wanted to give you a very quick overview of what it looks like. So in this plot, you have the five documents that are retrieved and appended to the context, and every dot in this plot is one token within the document, right? And the scores here are the attribution scores that you get by applying the second part of the graph that we saw before, right? So in the study, we were trying two approaches. We were trying to set some thresholds based on like arbitrary thresholds like this, like the top 5%, or we were trying to do some calibration based on a set of gold examples with human annotations, right? And what we were showing is that it seems like this approach, well, we found contrasting a bit results on different models. It seemed to be working quite well for Zephyr, but not much for Llama in terms of recall specifically. No, sorry, in terms of precision for Llama. But in general, the cool part is that you can use the same model. So the model that you're using for generation, you can just do the attribution back, right? So it's not out of distribution. You don't need an external validator. And the calibration, we found that it did improve performance here.
What is your ground truth for that experiment? So when you do a precision recall measure for this, what is like what
So
kind
this
of
was
measure?
manually annotated human, so it's plausibility again, like it's human labels of like which context contain which information, right? So that's also a potential gap, right? Here we're trying to get a model perspective of what matters, right? So evaluating it against the human
Right. So
perspective, it's a bit of a.
assuming the model does it the way the human would do it.
Exactly,
Okay.
yeah.
Got it. Makes sense. How
Yeah.
do you, can you go back on this, right?
Yep.
How do you do the finding the influence generation tokens? Is it You've generated an entire answer without context.
With context.
With and without.
Without, we don't really need. So the ones that you have, the one with context, you want to look for every token, which ones have the highest KL divergence, basically,
Between.
between the with and the without. So the without setting is you take the with answer, you force it, basically. You force it there, and you just measure the probabilities
So for the
for every
next
token.
generating token,
Yeah, without context.
without context and with.
Exactly.
So like by then you already have generated like let's say 50 tokens with the context. Don't you think that would sort of influence which
For
one?
sure, for sure. So the idea here is really to try to trace how the context motivates the answer. Then I agree that there's going to be starting to have dependency within the answer, right? So our goal was really to pinpoint the like which kind of information is flowing from context to answer. The moment that it's internal to the answer, we weren't
Makes
looking at
sense.
that, right? But in principle, nothing would prevent you from adding the prefix of the answer to the context here, like autoregressively, right? And keeping it in the loop, kind of. So you could do that, yeah. I think in general, Zephyr here was a bit better as a model compared to Llama 2. So it could be a factor here. You can see the scores are a bit higher overall. Performance, like not in terms of attribution, but it was reflected somehow in the attribution sides. Yeah, so Zephyr is a Mistral. It could have been, but we didn't look into that very much.
Qualitatively, did you see anything interesting and differences between the two models?
I have to say it wasn't super different. We had some examples in the appendix of the paper that were quite interesting, that it seemed like they behaved a bit differently, but it wasn't super remarkable, I have to say.
Just a quick clarification. So, in terms of the unit for the precision, are you calling the unit documents or tokens?
Tokens.
That's pretty high.
All right. And I just wanted to close this part. We have the API within InSeek to do exactly this. So this example, it's quite interesting, I think. So if you have here, I was prompting the model to asking it, when was the most successful player in NBA history born? This is a pretty small model. It's a small LM2, like 200 million parameters, so super small. So the model is giving something nonsensical here, which makes sense. But then it was saying the most successful player in NBA history is Steven John something. And John was found to be context sensitive, right? So then if you open the little toggle here, what you see is the retrieved documents with RUG, right? And then you see the scores for all the tokens within the retrieved documents. So you can see that for John, the model is mostly looking at Steven John here, right? In the third document, which makes sense. So it's kind of like it's copying from the third document to mention that, right? But I thought it was interesting because you can also see the contrastive alternative that the model would have produced without context, right? And if you know basketball a little bit, Stephen Curry could be a good choice here for saying the most successful player, right? So the model kind of knew the answer before getting the context, but then it was biased by the context to give a wrong answer. So yeah, I thought it was an interesting example. So as a bridge between the first and second part, there is some work that we're doing about using attribution to compress COT reasoning with some collaborators from Italy. So the idea here is that we have our original COT trace in a reasoning model. So now we're trying mostly GPT-OS S20B. And you have these very performant gradient-based attribution methods that can identify, given the answer that the model produces, which are the tokens that motivate this answer the most within the reasoning chain, right? So what you can do is that you can score this token and then use some sort of thresholding again to select only the ones that are the most salient towards the answer. So our idea here was, cool, this lets you do this post-hoc, but what if we train a probe to predict these tokens given an unseen cot trace, right? So given an unseen trace, what we want is the probe will pick out the tokens that are found to be salient by our attribution method, right? But live, so not post-hoc, just given a token, we decide whether it's salient towards the final prediction or not, right? And so one initial experiment with patching that we had here was given the full COT trace, we select the relevant token with attribution, and we just take the token identities here, so the actual token, and we plug it into a new COT like reasoning block that only has these tokens, right? So this is not going to make any sense because it's just random tokens, right, that were picked out. But then what we also do is that we patch the states corresponding to these tokens into these positions, right? So these are not just the tokens, but are actually the patched activations across all layers. And what we were seeing here is that in most cases, the model can get to the final response, which I don't know about you, but I personally found kind of surprising, but I'm curious to hear your opinion. Yeah.
So sometimes the answer is
That's right. That's right. And that's why I say offline is biased actually in the title. So the problem there is that you could have this kind of shortcut that we saw in many examples, that one of the salient token is the answer in the reasoning chain. And it's kind of hard to control for that because we tried stopping right before that, so trying to ablate everything from the first occurrence, but then it would be something like, so 23 plus 57 is, you know, so you're selecting that instead, and it's still trivial to get to the answer, right? Without doing the full reasoning. So then the live thing that we're trying to do, and that seems to be working well, is to use this train probe on the COT to select as a decoding strategy for sampling. So at generation time, you can consider a prefix of the COT. Then from this prefix, you can sample, for example, four options, and you can apply the probe to the tokens of these four options to detect where there is a higher density of tokens that are found salient towards the final answer, right? And then this guides your selection of the next sequence, right? So I would pick the first one as the continuation, keep going, and what we're seeing so far, we still have to kind of like finish all our evaluations for that, but it seems like we can reach basically a very high like agreement with, let's say, the full COT with much shorter sequences or something ar alongside these lines, let's say. So this is a bit work in progress, but I wanted to show you. A any question on that? Yeah.
Yes, I'm curious, but ahead of that, but like, how would you avoid it starting to just repeat tokens the first the answer? I guess okay, you're not sure about that. But,
What do you mean?
oh,
To repeat tokens?
like say, imagining this in like a training set, imagining, it's a math problem, and it says like 33 plus 34, then it would be salient token changing, sort of. Theory, you could just say 33 plus 44 repeatedly as a way to like show up more.
Yeah, but then we still measure the final capacity of outputting the answer, right? So what you mean is that it could just keep going and we would never finish the reasoning or something like that.
Think it's an
No, it makes sense. Yeah, I mean, definitely there should be some stopping condition, right? Otherwise, it could be like that you enter this kind of loop of just outputting only this kind of final tokens that are always salient, right? So we're still thinking about that, yeah.
So the fact that like we even can train probes, to me it seems to imply that like the model is like ahead of time, like kind of writing in like a latent scratch pad, like, oh, I know I'll need this later. I'll use this later for the output. And sort of I guess in this way of like choosing among the best of four branches, optimizing for that signal of, you know, what I'm gonna need later results in I guess denser COTs, or like, I just want to get like an understand, like is this sort of the intuition that you're thinking?
Yeah, I think the intuition is that there's gonna be tokens that the model knows are relevant for later, kind of. And I think that's the signal that is kept. While other tokens are kind of like a way to get more compute, kind of like, you know, this kind of, oh, wait, let me think through this, right? This is not like answer directed. It's more like, I need more computation to get to something meaningful. Let me just kind of stall, you know, for a bit, kind of. So, yeah.
I guess
Yeah, just.
just yeah, quick follow-up. Do you think you'd see a trend in this direction if you like, for example, you looked at checkpoints of like the full mode reasoning or like the RL stage, do you think you'd see like it start to generate more of these like highly dense COTs?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have an assumption here. Like I don't know what to expect on of about looking at this specific model. Yeah.
How I'm interpreting this is that the model is doing some kind of compaction in its intermediate tokens that it needs to maybe compact information from the token, from the context, and also like some information that is going to be relevant later. But isn't that this exact thing that the model needs to do that makes the first framework you presented much harder? Because, I mean, let's say the model has some context about few smaller in its RAG documents.
Right.
It decided to compact this stuff into some token that if you just look at the token itself,
Yeah.
it is just has nothing to do with
Yeah,
smaller or
that.
fewer. And then even when you do this gradient attribution and stuff like that, then that token that is apparently not related to the
Yeah.
concept you're looking for, it will also get boosted. Because it is also storing some information.
Right. I think conceptually, yes, that would be the case. My observation, though, is that this kind of compaction doesn't happen usually on like end of sequence tokens, right? So there were all these previous work, for example, these thought anchors work by Neil, by some people at Mats, right? I think that were using end of sequence within the COT to split the sentences, right? And we tried to look at that. So when we were thinking about compaction, we were thinking, can we just bound the sequence based on the sequence boundary, right? But actually, it seems like there is not this kind of thing that the information is gathered at the end, right? Can be used for reading, but something that we're also seeing in the goal-directedness part is that it cannot really be used causally, right? Meaning like information is moved there, but it's a bit diffuse, kind of, right? So the attribution is more likely to pick out the original source of the information rather than this final part. At least that's what we are observe right now that we're digging a bit into the results, right? It doesn't need to be, but I think it makes sense that like the gathering happens when you need to predict something, right? Kind of like if you think in this case, if you have to do an intermediate prediction, then there is the point where the attention is looking backwards and is trying to gather this information, not like at the end of the sentence, right? So then this step would anyways be part of this kind of salient elements, right, that get picked out. So then I feel like it mitigates a bit the problem that you mentioned. Yeah, something like that. It's kind of like beam search with a probe that controlled for how much this is relevant to the final outcome. Okay. Yeah.
I guess. Hoping that maybe relevant for there's a
So we did look at entropy actually of the distribution across tokens as a signal initially, to try to understand, because there was some work that was using entropy as a signal of like, oh, the model is more uncertain, so maybe that's here where it takes the decision, right? And in mathematical problems, we found that low entropy on digits was kind of related to the final outcome. So digits were salient. But apart from that, we didn't find that entropy was very predictive of that. That's why we moved to attribution as a way to get a more output-oriented signal of what matters, right? So yeah, the probe does this kind of attribution, but online, not from knowing the answer, right? So I was also kind of surprised that it works, but it seems to be working quite well. So we were getting something like 85, 90% accuracy to get out these tokens. Yeah. So you do the attribution from the final output. You get scores for all the sequence, but then the probe is trained given the current token in the sequence. So you kind of regenerate the same sequence. And then you want to predict the score without knowing the final output, right? The scores on which the probe is trained are based on the final output, but the probe is trained only on the local output that gets generated one step at a time, right? That is annotated with those scores that you pre-computed, kind of, right?
What do you give as input to the probe?
So the probe just gets the binary, yeah, it gets the sequence up to this token, and it gets the binary label that is the, you know, this kind of like with the threshold we set whether the token is meaningful or not towards the prediction. Yeah.
Did you find any patterns like in math problems? Could it just be like all the numbers are
Yeah.
relevant?
So in math problems, our problem was that initially we work with entropy and that there were these kind of patterns of low entropy always salient. But then the moment we moved to like MMLU or something like that, this completely broke our analysis, right? So that's why we moved to attribution. And now we started doing some experiments there. It seems more robust, right? So what we want to test is also generalization, kind of like you train the probe on math, you test on MMLU, right? Yeah.
They have a submission we're preparing for Colin that looks very similar, so maybe we can talk
Nice. Well,
later.
yeah, sure.
One thing I can mention, we also had the attribution scores, but we added two properties that I think are important and may help with some of your experiments. One is you want to know if these steps or parts of the train of thoughts are actually plausible for the model. So are they high likelihood given the prefix? As you mentioned that you sometimes are left with things that are they don't make sense, right?
You mean when you patch
No,
here?
when you patch even before, right?
Yeah, but actually here we just do the coding from the models.
Not in the report.
Yeah.
Talking about just identifying what was it? Yeah, I think when
Oh,
you
yeah.
started, you said, "Oh, these things are they don't make sense." But if you add the hidden, if you patch the hidden
But
state,
yeah, it was
then
for the
they could.
patching. Yeah, but this is postdoc, right? So,
No, I
yeah.
understand. But you can infer, you can require that the steps you identify,
Right.
we call it attainable, attainability. So that they are something the model will assign high probability given the
Interesting.
prefix, right? And the other thing, which is also related to whether the model is just writing the answer or shortcut to the answer, you want to get rid of those. And you can get rid of those. So you want things that you cannot predict the answer just from the given step. Right? You don't want
Right.
them to be enough for predicting it. So you can get rid of them as well.
Yeah.
Basically you want steps that are sufficient for predicting the answer when the full question and prefix is
That's
given.
right. But so you're segmenting still at the step level, right?
We're submitting it. So.
Makes sense. Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. Now, quickly on to the goal directedness part that a lot of people were interested in. So the setup here, the whole motivation about this is that most of the evaluations about goal directedness in agents are based on a behavioral study, right? So we study whether the agents can do the task. And you usually use as a metric of goal directedness whether the agent is accurate or efficient with respect to the optimal policy, right? If it takes more or less the same amount of steps or more or less the same steps. So the problem of this is that the model capabilities of getting to the answer are a big confounder, right? Because if the model is just not able to get to the answer, it might be the most goal directed, but it just breaks, right? So our idea for this project was, can't we ground this study into the representation that the model builds about the environment to try to get a better sense from those about the capabilities of the model? Meaning, is the model just failing at representing the environment and this leads to a failure in taking action, or is the environment represented well, right? So our setup is with a 2D grid world that looks like this, with different densities of obstacles. So from 0 to 1 that we say basically corridors, right? And this grid word is passed as a text to the LLM, and it's represented as you see there. So we put a lot of care to make sure that every cell is a single token. This helps a lot with the analysis on the mechanistic side of things, right? All right. So this is the kind of prompt that we use. So the model is given like, you are controlling an agent. This is your legend, like GA, the wall. Your objective is to get from your position to the goal while avoiding walls. And at every turn, the model can only say one of four actions. So it's step by step. One conversation turn is one step. And this is the expected output format, right? So then we feed in at every observation the grid state here. The model has to take a step. Then we parse the step, we use the system behind to get to the next observation. So the setup for the evaluation in the behavioral setup is we have six densities from empty to fully corridors. We have five sizes, so 7 by 7 up to 15 by 15, 10 grids per sizes and 10 trajectories per grid, right? So overall 3,000 trajectories. All right. So this is a first view of like how different complexity causes the model to fail more. So what you see here is the density on the x-axis. You see the grid sizes here, and you see the distance to the goal. So this distance to the goal is measured step by step using the optimal policy, right? So just to clarify, the grid word is a 2D grid word, fully observable. So you can, at every step, just do the A star policy to measure what's the minimal path, basically. So you can see here that the more the sizes increase, the more the failures start to happen, basically. But even for cases in which in the original size, so higher densities, for the smaller size, the model would do it perfectly. At higher densities for bigger sizes, the model starts to fail, right? So in general, we find behaviorally that bigger grids causes failures even for setups that before didn't, right? Yeah. So you can see that here there's nothing above 10 actions because the grid is just a 7 by 7, right? Because these grids are empty, they don't have obstacles, so the shortest path is quite straight, right? Well, in this case, you might have to go through the corridors, right? Yeah. So another thing that we were testing is the robustness to instrumental goals. So we had three setups here. A setup in which the model needs the key to get to the goal via a door. A setup in which there is a key, but there's no door. So the model actually could just disregard the key, doesn't care about the key. And a setup in which the distance of the goal is the same, but there is a key in one path and no key in the other, right? So what we saw here is that in the first setup, the model has a 100% success rate in this smaller 9 by 9 grid. So it means that it can always get to the key, pick up the key, get to the door, open it, get to the goal, right? Which is great. And the success rate is also very high for the key no door case, but you can see that in 17% of the cases, in the key no door case, the model still picks up the key, right? And the key has this key attractor bias is basically 75% of actions are basically the model going slightly towards the key, right? When it shouldn't care about that. So our idea here is about this attractor, right? So the key semantically in games makes sense, right? If there is a key, you probably need it, right, for doing something. So I think it's kind of interesting to see that this leaks into this setup where the model doesn't have to pick it up, but just does. Yeah.
How do you distinguish from an agent that just like does a random walk? Is an agent that does a random walk will also get 100% success rate eventually.
That's right.
It would also have 100% key people grade on the left, some random-ish rate on the right.
Yeah, I didn't mention this, but the number of maximal step in the trajectory that we allow is dependent on the grid size, and it's something like I think twice or three times the grid size. So it's something like 27 at most for the 9x9.
Such that a random agent would have very low success
That's
rate.
right. Yeah.
And how do you give these rules to the model? Is it through prompting or?
Yeah. So in the prompt, there is another version of this prompt in which we just mention that this is a key, but we don't say anything about it. We just
Like if there's a door, you don't say any of these things.
In the door case, we say you need the key to open the door. But in the other case, we just remove that part. We just say, here is a key.
And remind me which models you're testing for this?
GPT-OSS20B. Yeah.
There's no training.
There's no training. Just out of the box. Yeah.
And are you doing actions based on like a gym environment or is it just?
Yeah, so it's we're using this gym, this gym that is normally used for 2D grid words, right? I don't remember how it's called. Yeah,
Is it multi-spin or you do it like a fresh prompt? Like you have a
it's a fresh
you have
prompt.
an action,
It's
it does
stateless.
the
Yeah.
action, and give it a fresh prompt with
Yeah,
prompt state.
stateless. Yeah.
Is it just curious if you were to say not to get the key, would it not get the key in the
This
case?
we didn't try, but we just wanted to test the ambiguous case. Yeah, I imagine so. Yeah. And also we saw this bias towards going to the key path, even in the case where it didn't need to, right? So, yeah.
Does this bias occur whether or not there was keys in the training?
Training data?
No, there is nothing.
No,
This is
this is
only.
just GPT-OSS.
Okay,
Yeah.
so you don't know.
No, I imagine so.
Your standard emoji for the key that you're using is
Yeah, it's like K or something.
if you put a little poop emoji there, would
Yeah.
it
That's a good question. I think it would be interesting to try. Yeah.
I guess what I'm getting at is it, does it just attend to anything that's there or things it knows from prior games that
Yeah, I mean, our assumption is that the key, like the model saw games, definitely, right? And if it knows that this is a key, it knows that keys are picked up in games. And so it does it,
Or
right?
maybe it's a visual processing thing,
But
since
it's just a K, right, in the map. So it shouldn't
you should make
matter.
it like lava squirt.
Yeah, exactly. Or like the poop emoji. I think it's a great idea.
So
Yeah.
if he's not on the path, I guess without the radio, he will still get it.
Yeah, so in these cases, most of the cases, it's not on the path. And still, we see this key attraction bias, right? Yeah.
In those cases, you don't tell about the key at all or doors whatsoever.
It knows that there's this symbol is a key,
But you didn't
but
tell about doors. But in the other one, you did
nothing.
tell about doors. I wonder if you did tell about doors, it wouldn't have picked up the key because you're like, oh, I know what this is for. And there is no
That's a
door.
good question. I don't know. Yeah.
Be more convinced of the numbers if you had pairs of grids where the shortest path is some solution, and then you put a key and then you have a key and then you compare like the length of the path
Yeah.
solution, show that the path length actually increases with the key.
Yeah. So it is the case that it increases. It just we don't have it in the table here, but it is like the model does get out of its way to get to the key. Yeah. Yeah. I think personally, the most exciting thing about this, so here is purely behavioral, right? But I would be very excited to do probing on the key state and to see does the model see it as a goal in this case versus in this case, right?
Or you should do your attribution and see if it's
Yeah,
because of the
I don't
key
know.
mentioned in the film.
That could be, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we didn't try with more attractors, but yeah.
Is there a situation where it's like is it just like here's this goal? Is it like do you have like anything encouraging to find the optimal goal? Because I could go
Yeah.
down the
So in here we say you should aim to reach the goal using the least amount of steps. So there is an explicit instruction. So quickly about cognitive map probes. The idea here is that we have our original grid, and we pass this to the model again that needs to pick one of four actions. And what we do is that we take intermediate states of these, so we take the activation at those, and we use it to train a probe to predict every cell in the grid, right? So this is just an MLP probe that is trained given the activation plus an XY coordinate, so 0, 0. This activation 0, 0 predict that this is wall, right? So we can train at scale over all the grid sizes, even using a padding token for the missing positions, right? So for bigger, smaller grids, we'll have this pad to use it for the same probe. So the interesting part is the probe definitely is able to pick up almost 100% probability the grid size. So it knows when to predict pad given the activation. And the other interesting thing that we do is that here we take the final tokens at the end of the prompt. So it's like the template tokens at the end of the prompt. But then we repeat the same thing by training a probe on the final token at the end of reasoning, right? So our idea is, can we compare how the probe performs before and after reasoning? So here it's the same, right? So for example, here in this example, the initial probe represents well the environment where the model crashed into the wall, but the final probe actually makes the model think that it could just go straight, right? As you can see from the reconstructions, the probes are not perfect, right? So the way that we build this cognitive map is simply the argmax of the classes of the cells. So you could have multiple goals in the reconstructed map, right? Hypothetically. And multiple agents, yeah.
Of this, I see that the green rectangles are goals, but how did it became a goal? Like what did you do to add those goals?
Here. So what we're doing is just using the probe. Every cell in this map is a prediction of the probe that is given the activation and needs to reconstruct what's the original identity for that cell. So that's why I'm saying here the probe is uncertain where the goal is. It kind of gets it, but it's a bit uncertain between these two options.
So your ground truth map is the one on up here.
It's the real one that the
That's the
model
one
is
that's
prompting with.
fed in.
Yeah.
And you have a special like Unicode character for that green square.
Yeah, it's G. It's just
Okay,
G,
whatever it
goal.
is. Yes. And but then your probe basically the cover is used in a smeary area.
Yeah.
I'm just translating, is that right? Any thoughts?
Yeah, so if you could just think, how did you train the problem?
So we take this activation at a specific layer. The final
Okay.
ones, so it's the last three tokens of like the template tokens of at the end of the prompt and at the end of the reasoning. So these are two separate probes though. It's like pre-reasoning, post-reasoning, right? And we train, let's say, mostly for layer 15. We also try these two other layers, but let's say layer 15, we take all the activations for the final tokens of the prompt. We train the probe to predict every cell identity given that activation.
This is surprising that it seems like it's hard for the model to recognize where is the goal because you give the map, right? You give the map
The prompt.
so seems a very simple task. It's just
Yeah, but now I'm not probing the map identity, like,
yeah, okay.
so I'm probing a
It's
final,
like if
yeah.
you look at that and then close your eyes.
Exactly. Kind of, yeah.
Because they have a different task.
Yeah, that's right. And
So the last three tokens, as in the arrow tokens.
no. So what I mean is the template token. So GPT-OSS has these tokens that are like end start assistant, right? Something like this. We just concatenate the activations of those.
Does the probe always predict the first step correctly?
This one?
Like if the there's like some rough idea of the math,
Yeah.
is it like what the first thing that the first action that you need to take?
The immediate neighborhood.
Like is that
Yeah, in general, the
predicting
neighborhood
correctly?
is quite good. The plot that I had here is actually how correct the agent and goal positions are across different sizes. You can see that this decreases, but like for seven, for example, it's quite high. And what the plot on the right shows is like the Manhattan distance of all the argmax. So like, for example, let's say that I have this grid, right, where I have three cells that the argmax is a goal. Then I measure how far these are from the original goal. And you can see that even for larger grids where the accuracy is lower, the Manhattan distance is like 1.5. So it's a lower accuracy, but it's always like within a neighborhood of the real position, right? So it's just more diffuse. And this is the performance. So what you see here, like the accuracy, the precision, sorry, is very low, right, of the probe for the agent and the goal. But you can see that the recall is very high. And this is because the model, the probe tends to predict like a cloud of points around the real position. So the recall is generally high, but the actual precision, so to pinpoint exactly that spot, is quite low. And you can see that compared to pre and post reasoning, there is a drop in performance, especially for agent and goal positions, right? So this, like our assumptions based on this, is that the model goes from modeling the environment before reasoning to modeling the next action to take, right? So the final thing for this is about, well, now we have cognitive maps. Does the behavior of the model agree with the cognitive map, right? That's the kind of goal that we had in the beginning. And as of now, it's not so clear, actually, the response. So what you see here in the table, you have grid sizes and densities. Then you have the accuracy for an action with respect to the original grid. So this is like accuracy of actions given the prompt. And this is the actual accuracy with respect to the cognitive map, right? So the decoded grid. You can see that this is generally lower than this, right? Although the differences even out for bigger grids. So in general, it seems like the actions are more consistent with the original grid than with the decoded one. But we also see that among all the errors that are made within the grids, like there is a good proportion. This is like 60% of this part that is an error that are actually agreeing with the decoded map. So we find what we say here, high recovery, which is this last metric, it means that wrong actions that the model takes are mostly in agreement with the cognitive map that we decode, right? So this, I mean, it's only still probing, but it's some signal that maybe we can justify a lot of the action, not as a lack of goal directedness, but actually as a lack of capability to represent the map well, right? And this is like still so much to do about these experiments. So the thing that we really, really would like to do in this line is causal experiments. So right now we started doing some stuff here. In particular, patching the location of agents and goals, of course, to see whether this changes something, but also patching the neighborhoods of these things. Since we saw that the positions are diffuse, we want to see if we can patch the neighborhoods. It's a bit like related to what was presented last week about VLMs, right? So if you patch the neighborhood, does it actually affect the final prediction? And then to test these cognitive maps in all these settings. So I think the last one is especially interesting. So if we have a partially observable setting in which we occlude part of the map, we observe some action in some direction, do we see that the probe indeed finds that the goal is kind of that way, right? According to the model.
See whether the cognitive map is generalized into different tasks. For example, a task just asked to repeat the map,
yeah,
which is a simple task that uses.
Yeah, you could imagine that this probably will have a much stronger representation of the map, given that it needs to, you know.
What I'm curious is whether the location of the cognitive map stays the same. But whether it would be that they're the same tokens in the same layers.
Yeah, I think it would probably be different. I think it depends on the task, definitely. At least the sharpness with which things are represented, I would expect it depends on the task, right? For this task, I expect the goal and the agent position to be more sharply represented because they are functional to getting to the goal, right? Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious. Yeah, we should also test that. Yeah, definitely. Nice. Yeah.
You mentioned that when you're talking about the probes, that immediately they get 100% accuracy. What did you mean by that?
No, so the probe don't have 100% accuracy. They have 100% accuracy in detecting the size of the grid. So like the padding tokens to the edges of the grid are very reliably predicted, right? Which is not a given necessarily, right? From the activation. So
the cognitive maps that you noted earlier, it's one probe
yeah.
that takes XY coordinates and these three concatenated embeddings as an input.
Yeah.
It's just one probe for everything.
Exactly. So I just want to show you very quickly something fun. So we have a demo for cognitive maps that is quite nice. So here, let's say that I select pre-reasoning probes for size 11 and for complexity 0.6. So I load this grid. So this is my input, right? This is the input to the GPT-OSS. And I can actually, I have the full trace already run. So I can actually play this and I can see the agent going around. So for now it's optimal. Then now it's doing something weird. Then now it's getting back on track. Oh, going up. All right. So what actually can we do? Let's say that I reset here. So this is the first step, right? I can go down here. I have the prompt. So I can see the prompt. And I can see the model output that has all the reasoning, right? So actually here we're storing also the top five next tokens, etc. So here it was a pre-reasoning probe. So we have the last few tokens. You see these three tokens that are the ones where the probe is trained, right? So we can apply the probe here and see the cognitive map here. So you can see these are a bit faded. They look like walls, but actually it's 70% empty, 23% walled. So it's more like empty than wall. But the agent position, it's pretty stably encoded here, right? And then we can actually play this. And this is what the cognitive map looks like when the model is moving around. So you can see that the agent position is kind of robust, although it's not very precise, but you know, you can see that it gets next to the goal and then it reaches it, right? Live demos are always stressful. But yeah, so we have this kind of thing that helped us a lot to form a bit of intuition about how this works. Yeah.
In a specific token, so is it also configurable to see in different tokens?
So it's the final three tokens of the prompt in this case. So with the pre-reasoning probe is always there. Yeah.
It would be nice if the user could then perform live interventions in this.
Yeah, it would be nice. So, I mean, this ties nicely to the last three slides I have about an insight and an interp. But I don't know if you guys are tired or if you can survive for three more slides. So it's just a very quick overview of like what we're thinking about on the endif side. Yeah. About. Yeah.
The protocol that the application is there and it's very clearly extractable, but I think the other question was like the like it's just one probe doing this. If the probe was like more powerful, maybe
or a definition that yields stronger findings.
Yeah, the problem there is always like how much is the probe actually doing the
Right.
task instead of the model, right? As Jonathan teaches us.
Just, if you could just make this a bit more high dev, get some of the conclusions that you're doing.
Yeah.
Did you like experiment with different ways of providing the map itself and the prompt to the model?
So we thought a bit about making it kind of like an egocentric view. We would expect that to probably work better for like the model to actually get to the goal because it's kind of like at least it's not gonna hit walls with its head, right? But we it's kind of hard to go from the kind of engines that are like that allow you to do these kind of observations to an egocentric view, right? So we postpone that part for now. Yeah.
Why was that so good? The demo was that like pre-computed or?
Yeah, so the traces are all saved. All the probing results, everything is saved. But you can play with it. There are several of them, right? So just have fun. It's on Hugging Face. Yeah. All right. So for the very final things for NDIF, so as you many of you know, right now we have this beautiful server that hosts a lot of models and that are gonna change soon, right? So we announced recently on the Discord that we're gonna drop the Llama 405B, that we're trying to host Kimi, which is gonna be great because it's also gonna have the VLM part, which is very useful, and other more modern models, Qwen 3.5, and other reasoning models and VLMs. So as of now, we have nInsight, which is the primary way to access internals, which is quite high, quite a low level, right? So you have to variety of traces, you have to access components internally at a low level. And this is meant mostly for people that actually are building new interpretability methods, so most of you guys, right? And one of the new things that we have here is that we have these new skills that allow you to kind of use nInsight more effectively with coding agents. So if you haven't checked this out, this is something nice. You can just load them in Claude Code or Codex, and it kind of teaches the model to do patching or do logic lens in a bit more natural way, or use VLLM. I think that was one of the things that Woog was working on, right? Skills for VLLM usage that could also be relevant. So the newer part of the ecosystem is where I'm mostly focusing for my work. So as maybe some of you know, there was this library, nInterp, from Clément Dumas that has been recently integrated in our ecosystem. And the idea here is to provide some sort of interface that is a bit more similar to Transformer Lens to access the models, right? Which means you have this standardized naming across different models. So you just write once the code, you just run your evaluation on several models, plus several kind of like syntactic sugar to access model internals. So I think in the future, it's reasonable to imagine that most researchers, like, I don't know, NLP people or computer vision people that are not interp people will use something like this to do their research, right? Probably not down to the level of nInsight. So here we have a low-level API that is this kind of like shallow wrapper around nInsight that is just basically syntactic sugars mostly to make everything uniform. But on the other hand, what I'm focusing on right now is we want to have also a higher level API that allows you to do very simple, standardized, and efficient method calls. For example, let's say that you want to do patching. You're just going to call patching with that model, with this position. It returns you a structured object that it's easy to serialize, to save, you know, to run your analysis on that. So kind of all baked in, efficient and all baked in. And this is going to make it easier to work with Workbench. So how many of you have tried Workbench? Out of curiosity, one person, two people. So Workbench is the UI that we are building for nInsight, which back then was only Logit Lens, but recently I was doing patching on Llama 405B, which I think is pretty nice. So it kind of supports more advanced use cases at the moment, but we're trying to make it even better. And we imagine that workbench is going to be mostly for researchers, right? So like people that maybe are not even in machine learning, but want to prototype in their domain, or educators that want to showcase, right? We used it a lot in David's class also. Yes.
I feel almost
Yes.
I have a question. So why build higher level tooling if research code will increasingly be mediated by agents? So on the last slide, you showed these skills.
Yeah.
Say I want a UI for patching. I'll just want for patching, give it the site documentation, or if I want it to create some kind of experiment, so we need to ask it to run some patching experiments,
That's
and
right.
it can figure out the sort of lower level details for me. So, like in a year from now, you think these will be useful to researchers?
So you're asking specifically about this part, I imagine, right?
Well, even an answer.
Well, but you w would you argue that the standardization is just going to make everything easier to run, right? You have one script instead of five,
Better presentation.
right?
Oh, you mean across models?
Yeah.
Sure.
So that's the low level kind.
The workbench, though. But yeah, workbench and maybe high level
Well,
APIs.
Workbench, you would argue that the UI is going to be useful for educators or like people
Well,
that.
but I could. It's like amazing. Whatever UIs I
Yeah.
ask for.
So does this, I guess, only pertain to this, or are you seeing like why build anything really?
Big question. Yeah, no, I think this is actually an increasing question in the industry, which is like there's been a whole business of like building software tools for people,
Yeah.
and like with like where a bunch of businesses have some business problem that they have, and people are like, oh, we're gonna build a software to solve that. And increasingly with coding agents, like a lot of companies are like, oh, like we don't have to pay them to develop that for us. We can actually have Claude to
So.
develop actually internal opinions of the vendor, right? So actually it is a general like problem in the industry, I think, now. And
But
I
if you
just
wanted to teach a curriculum, I guess, with Workbench across schools, like why wouldn't you want one single, like I mean, this is written with a lot of agents, like we're just the ones doing it, right? I mean, if you wanted to teach the same thing in California, as you do here, wouldn't you want the same UI across and go and show
So is the
that there?
purpose like that Workbench will be educational, like
And
I don't know.
prototyping, I would say also. So kind of like if I had to do very easy patching experiments where I just want to patch at every layer, see what does it do. I am quite comfortable at doing it with drag and dropping arrows in Workbench at this point, right? I would rather start there and modify my prompt and retry, right, on a big model on the remote rather than having to run my code experiment to see the result. I think that's pretty valuable. But so my answer to that is this, probably. And the fact that I think the standardization that is enforced between these two is useful for this final thing, that is, we want to have a gateway to make evals compatible to our interpretability stack, right? And so you need some format here where you can bring in evals result in a way that can be digested by this part, right? So if you're building custom stuff, there's no way to enforce this standard, right? I think.
Can you say more about
Yeah, so like the vision for that is the final slide, I promise. Is the fact that you like the vision for how evals are gonna work with interp is that most likely you want to run your evals or your analysis on a big data set with an inference optimized API, right? Like you run it on Inspect, you run it on Together AI, whatever, you know, you generate all that you have to generate. And then from there, so you're going to get some output from this that then can be parsed in some shared format, which is this INIF format that I was mentioning, where you can identify areas of interest for deeper investigation, right? So like in our case for goal directedness, you want to know, what happens at the end of template tokens before and after reasoning, for example, right? So then I would tag that postdoc after I have my full traits, right? And then from there, what you want to do, you want to apply your MacInterp toolbox on those locations, right? And that's going to be very efficient to run, right? Because you, like in the case before, you're not running the probe over all the position in the trace, or like logit length over all the position in the trace. You're running it where you need it, right?
This all supposed to be like an automated pipeline, or
I think the vision would be that you go towards something that is very easy to just, I did my evals with what the evals people are doing, right? Then I just have this bridging, and then I'm back into the end ecosystem, right? I can run my things in nInterp high level, I can serialize, I can load it, and I can just do my analysis there, right? So I think the standardization is what makes it worth more like structure, right? I agree that for prototyping, maybe for very specific stuff at the low level, you just have an insight and you build your own custom demo there, right? But I think for more complex scenarios, for like full evals over full data sets, that's probably more robust, right? But I'm happy to be convinced otherwise. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't like that. Be hopeful though, and have a few things on hold. The very thing. Maybe just the end. Well, I don't know. My initial skepticism is just like building things at a high level of abstraction. Always usability.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah.
Standard for what everyone uses, and you can compare results to anyone.
So I can also mention, for the educational perspective, right now we ran a little study that we're going to submit next week in David's class, with between Workbench and nInterp, using a shared UI, right? So you have a UI that is in the web, but then it's the same plots that are produced locally by your library, right? When you work on a Jupyter, for example. And we collected a lot of feedback from people, and in general, people found it intuitive to work with the same shared visualization, both in the kind of like drag and drop, no code web interface, than when you're designing your kind of intervention more manually, right? So I think it does make sense to have something shared there, right?
Attention study. I found more, like even with the one Workbench interface, it's you get pretty differing results with tiny changes. So having something standard and shared is still something so sensitive opportunity.
You can make it very efficient also. If you control the back end, you can like make it very quick, right?
You can make it more competitive with that. Will happen to high up the stack, the more likely scale. Just start from there and just go off through that.
That's it for me. Sorry for keeping you long. Any final question?
Is this close to a job though?
No. No. It was just a bit of a.
Felt like a job.
Yeah.
I would hire you, yeah.
Nice. I'm glad to hear. No, it wasn't planned as a job, though. No. What, sorry? Google Slides.
Just like manually.
Cool.
It's convenient to make figures for papers in Google Slides, because then it's plug and play for the presentation, right?
That's a lot of changes into that.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone.
You know.